You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of September 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's programme,
we have no confirmation of Gaddafi's whereabouts, but at least two of Gaddafi's sons have been detained. His regime is falling apart and is in full retreat.
It seemed like a good idea at the time. A new report into the intervention in Libya begs to differ. Where did it all go wrong? My guests, Sir William Patey and Tom Rivers, will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including plans by the European Union to set up a common military force and...
What we're seeing is a conversation about the war on whistleblowers that's been occurring easily for the last decade, but of course has escalated under the most recent president, who brought charges against more whistleblowers than all other administrations combined. And this is a chance for the public to have their say.
Whistleblower Edward Snowden says that an unjust war has been waged against whistleblowers, but then he would. Will we view him differently in years to come? And a Swiss rail company plans to introduce traffic lights for pedestrians. We'll ask which other places around the world could do with them. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Sir William Patey, an international affairs advisor at Control Risks, formerly UK ambassador to Afghanistan, Iraq, Sudan and Saudi Arabia. We're also joined by Tom Rivers, the London correspondent for ABC Radio News. Welcome both. Now, we are going to start with a clip of David Cameron, who was, until reasonably recently, Britain's Prime Minister and until very recently, the MP for Witney. This is him back in 2011, talking about the overthrow of Muammar al-Gaddafi.
The vast majority of Tripoli is now controlled by Free Libyan forces, although fighting continues and some of it is extremely fierce. We have no confirmation of Gaddafi's whereabouts, but at least two of Gaddafi's sons have been detained. His regime is falling apart and is in full retreat. Gaddafi must stop fighting without conditions and clearly show that he has given up any claim to control Libya. As for his future, that should be a decision for Chairman Jalil and the new Libyan authorities. The situation in Tripoli is clearly very fluid, and there is absolutely no room for complacency. Our task now is to do all we can to support the will of the Libyan people, which is for an effective transition to a free, democratic, and inclusive Libya.
Easier said than done, as these things often are. A new report by the UK Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee has been released just in time to be the door that hits Cameron on his way out of politics, accusing Cameron of severe failures and misjudgments before, during and after the intervention which helped remove Gaddafi from power. William Patey, first of all, have we learned much here that we didn't know or couldn't have guessed?
No, I don't think so, and I think it's a bit rich to try and blame Cameron for the current state of affairs in Libya, given that the Libyan intervention came in the wake of failure in Afghanistan and failure in Iraq, so there was looming failure in Syria. So, I mean, you're going to look at it in that context, and we would still have a civil war in Libya if we hadn't intervened. Gaddafi might have survived longer, but there would still be a civil war, there would still be an Islamist faction, there would still be anti-Gaddafi forces. So the idea that somehow Cameron needs to take the blame for much of this seems a bit rich.
Tom, these official self-flagellations have become increasingly popular in British politics in recent years. While acknowledging that mistakes and misjudgments can be made, isn't it the nature of a situation like Libya in 2011 that misjudgments and mistakes are obviously going to be made because nobody really at any stage has a complete idea what is going on? And this idea that the intelligence is faulty or incomplete, of course it is. You know, you are making, I think people forget that people in these offices are making the best guesses they possibly can with the information available.
Well, and you also hear the idea about false intelligence or inadequate intelligence. Maybe we're putting the cart before the horse. Maybe let's make our minds up and then we'll let's get the boys in to give us a report. We've heard that before too in Iraq. We're probably looking at a situation like that this way. We saw what happened in Afghanistan. We saw what happened in Iraq. Guess what? You know, if you lobotomize Libya, you might be in the same situation. And that's what we have right now.
I mean, is it possible, William, that, I mean, it's always been Tony Blair's defense about the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq that turned out not to exist, that he didn't know that in 2003. He genuinely and sincerely believed they did exist. All the intelligence had told him that he did exist. It did exist. One of the criticisms of this report is that the threat to Benghazi and its civilian population was exaggerated. And maybe it was, but if David Cameron didn't know that at the time, and he genuinely believed that some hideous massacre was imminent, did he do the wrong thing?
No, I'm sure. I remember it well. There was a threat of Gaddafi using tanks and aircraft against civilians in Benghazi. So there was clearly a humanitarian imperative to intervene. I mean, I think the criticism I've seen from sort of David Richards, the CDS, and John Sawyers, who was head of MI6 at the time, is saying that this wasn't the demise of Gaddafi wasn't a vital national interest of the UK in security, and that's fair enough, because had they not intervened and Gaddafi had repressed his own people and had survived in a civil war, I'm sure there'd be voices raised on saying, why aren't you doing something about this? So, you know, Cameron would have been...
Britain had been reasonably happy to deal with Gaddafi up until 2011.
Indeed. I mean, for us, a Gaddafi who was no longer supporting terrorism, mm-hmm. who no longer had nuclear weapons or aspirations to develop nuclear weapons, was not a problem for us. He was a human rights issue. There would have been lots of people who were, you know, I lived in Libya for 3 years and Gaddafi was a prime human rights abuser. But in terms of his threat to Europe, his threat to Britain, that threat didn't exist from Gaddafi.
This is the he may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch formulation.
Or he's certainly, you know, not necessarily our son of a bitch, but at least he wasn't threatening us anymore. And we certainly wouldn't have the migrant crisis of Gaddafi. Mm-hmm. I'm not advocating that we should have supported Gaddafi, but I'm just suggesting that had Cameron not intervened, or France and Britain not intervened, we could have a similarly messy situation in Libya.
Tom, one of the other things that David Cameron gets beaten up over in this report is failing to anticipate that Islamic State and similarly inclined organisations would then take root in Libya. Is there a persistent problem with, I guess, broadly Western secular democracies underestimating the power of religion when they decide to involve themselves in places like Libya?
Well, as we saw things unfold, wherever there's been a vacuum, just about everywhere, we've seen these elements sprout up, elements that weren't there or were suppressed, sometimes very violently, in the past. And near as damn it, they're going to show up. And they have shown up in Libya. Now they're dealing with the process of trying to extract that element right now. And it's costly in financial terms, in blood terms, and it's going to go on and on and on. And again, as we said at the top, very, very little thinking, saying what happens the day after Gaddafi is gone. And there's a UN kind of a government we like, but nobody else likes it. And then you're sitting there and you're looking at a Mad Max land there, and now try to put the pieces together.
But it was known at the time that the only real opposition to Gaddafi in his heyday were the Islamists. So, I mean, that was not, you know, that wasn't new. They were the only organised opposition. And so you could easily have deduced that getting rid of Gaddafi would have provided an opportunity for the Islamists. And I suppose the real criticism of France and Britain there was that we didn't do enough to ensure that Chairman Jalili and the kind of what you call the moderate opposition prevailed in Libya, in the same way as we did very little to ensure that the moderate opposition in Syria prevailed. Mm-hmm. We were half-hearted in our support for them, mainly because in the post-Afghanistan, post-Iraq, we are not prepared to commit ground troops. We're not prepared to be on the ground. There is no public support for that. So that limits our options.
Okay, well, let's move along now to an inevitable side effect of Britain's decision to leave the EU. Not that it appears in much hurry to actually do it. But this side effect has been and will be the resurrection of many ambitions fondly nurtured by hardcore Eurocrats, which have been resentfully shelved in sullen recognition that little cooperation from Les Rosebifs will be forthcoming. One such has long been some sort of European army. And surprise, surprise, EU Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker has used his State of the Union address since the UK UK's first State of the Union address since the UK's vote to quit, rather, to refloat exactly this idea, specifically an EU military headquarters to work towards a common EU force. Tom, is it clear to you, because it sure as heck isn't clear to me, what this is going to do that NATO doesn't?
You know, it's interesting. I was going back about almost 30 years ago, back when I used to travel back and forth to Brussels doing NATO and EU stuff at that time. And there was one day we came in early and Lord Carrington said, guys, I'll give you some quotes here for 5 minutes and we'll go to the bar. And he got a group of us around and he said, you know, the real game down the road decades is going to be, you know, European defense, a headquarters. I said, you can't be right. We're sitting in NATO. That's not. And lo and behold, that card has been raised again. And maybe it's because of Brexit that those remaining strong elements in Europe say now's the time that we got to come out and we got to try to solidify and make this more of a federalist kind of a security and defense, if you will, mechanism as well, dealing borders and also dealing with joined up military strategy, et cetera, et cetera. In conjunction, in parallel, though, with NATO, which is a kind of a crazy, crazy idea.
William, at the risk of sounding like a leader writer for the Daily Express, which I'm not, but is there something faintly absurd here about this idea being floated by a politician from a country whose standing military consists of 450 soldiers who spend most of their day standing outside palaces saluting?
Well, I think you just have to see Juncker and a few others as what I would describe as the Euro-federalist fanatics. There are a group of people who want a federal state of Europe, federal United States of Europe, and that's their aim, and it's always been their aim. And they're the, you know, they're the inheritors of Schuman and all of that. And the Brits have generally been a big break on all this. I mean, this is almost Juncker licking his lips. The troublesome Brits are leaving.
Well, there is a cultural gap, isn't there? I can remember being in Afghanistan in about 2003, I think it was, and the British soldiers at the time were quite unabashed in referring to the ISAF contingent as Euro Disney was the standard vernacular for
it. Yeah, I mean, we have opposed the European army on the grounds that we don't want a federal state of Europe, we'll always have, and there was no point to it while we had NATO, which was part of the collective defence. Indeed, there was a British fear that if the Europeans somehow actually did something quite effective as a European army, it would weaken NATO and it would lessen the US commitment to NATO. So we had a fear of that. Our response to this was a much ever closer Anglo-French cooperation, and we went quite a long way down that road, the Brits, to merge our, to make sure that the Brits and the French together had a really effective fighting force. Now, I think what we're seeing here, and we'll see more of it, is a tightening of the core of Europe. Getting closer and closer to a federal state. Now, whether that's the dream of the Euro fanatics, whether France's people will be prepared to go along with that or the other peoples of Europe is another matter. I think people like Juncker are out of touch with the people of Europe.
Because there is something quite primal here attached to national militaries, isn't there, Tom? It's not necessarily a rational response people have to them, but I think it's one thing, as William suggests, people are okay with their militaries cooperating with the militaries of allied nations to a certain extent. But once you start seeing your soldiers marching under another flag entirely, it's a tough political sell.
If there is a large terrorist incident and you have then you have troops, you know, floating in from other countries, yes, you don't want to see that on your streets. So it's a different kind of a climate. And I don't know how you sell it.
I mean, is there actually, as far as it's possible to tell, William, any strategic logic to it at all? I mean, military strategic logic, not political or ideological strategic logic.
Well, I would have thought so. I mean, I think European armies are quite small. So if you were going to fight a big war, I mean, I think Britain can just about field a division. I think the French can probably field a division. I'd be surprised if any other European country could field a division in a war. So there may be a logic in, I mean, certainly the logic of France and Britain cooperating was we could have a bigger force, we could share and we could have, and that makes a certain logic if for Europe and France and others, there are certain weapon systems that could be bought together. I mean, for instance, the advanced fighter aircraft, the Typhoon, is a Eurofighter.
True enough.
It was built by Spanish, British, mm-hmm. Germans, and French. And so collaboration on some very advanced weapon systems makes a lot of sense. But that's, you don't need to have a common army to do that.
Final thought on this one from you, Tom, and let's attempt optimism. Is it arguable that some sort of framework in common, as Mr. Juncker is suggesting, would make the EU's response to a future scenario, say, akin to Bosnia, to which the EU's response was infamously shambolic, would it make it more streamlined, more effective?
It may be in a peacekeeping role and saying, okay, you know, we've thought about this. This is how now we can get X number of troops in there very, very quickly. This is what we need, et cetera, as opposed to having to figure it out on the hoof. That might be useful, but I can't see it as a strategic fighting force. And for the reasons we just described, everybody wants to do their own thing. And there's a whole issue again. what if there was a Falklands type of, you know, scenario down the road, and one of the countries wanted to pull away and view it differently from the rest of Europe? There's going to be those kind of conflicts down the road.
The political control would be very difficult, exactly, because they certainly wouldn't give it to the European Commission. And I saw in Afghanistan, within NATO, a European force within NATO, all the different countries had national caveats. So you'd have forces together, and a German force wasn't allowed to go there because they
I remember this at the time as
so
well.
So we all had national caveats. And I think, you know, the Brits were about the only force fighting within NATO that didn't have any caveats. We'd do anything, anywhere, anytime, really. But there were lots of other national caveats which varied from country to country.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Tom Rivers and Sir William Patey. Coming up next, Swiss rail authorities want to introduce traffic lights to control pedestrians. Is it a good idea? Stay tuned.
Trump or Clinton? Clinton or Trump? If, like me, you're not American, you don't get a vote. But that doesn't mean we won't be affected. Welcome to the global election.
America is critical to the maintenance of peace and security in the world, not least because of what it stands for as a democratic nation, a guardian of freedom and the values of democratic nations.
From war and peace to the economy and the environment, what happens in America has an impact on us all. A large part of that is influenced by the president, whoever he or she may be. So in the run-up to November's vote, join me, Steve Bloomfield, on Monocle 24 as we look at what this election will mean for the rest of the world. That's the global election with Steve Bloomfield, coming soon to Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, still with me, Sir William Patey and Tom Rivers. Now, in the eyes of many, Chelsea Manning is already martyr to one cause, that of freedom of information, having received a 35-year prison sentence for passing more than 700,000 secret files to WikiLeaks. Last week, she threatened to become a martyr to another cause, beginning a hunger strike in protest at the military's refusal to provide the US soldier, formerly known as Bradley Manning, with gender transition surgery. The army now seems to have relented, and the hunger strike is off. But have we yet figured out entirely what to think about modern-day whistleblowers and or leakers? William, looking at Chelsea Manning's case in isolation, 700,000 secret files passed to WikiLeaks, in return for which a 35-year prison sentence. On its own merits, is that a worthwhile sacrifice?
Well, I don't think it is. And I think you've got to... I don't think Chelsea Manning is a whistleblower. I just think Chelsea Manning was seduced by WikiLeaks and there was no real cause to it. I think there's a difference between Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning. I mean, Edward Snowden believed that the power of the state and the control it had over data had got out of hand. Now, whether you agree with him or not, he had a legitimate whistleblowing agenda. I don't think Chelsea Manning did. I mean, Chelsea Manning just indiscriminately downloaded what was on his computer at the time and gave it to WikiLeaks. I think we have a problem that in the West there's an assumption that we're not allowed to have secrets, that you know, everything should be out there and open. And we do need to be able to keep secrets. So I do think we have to take a judgment about what is a genuine whistleblower and what is just a leaker. And I certainly come down on the side that Edward Snowden at least has a case for being a whistleblower. I think Chelsea Manning is basically just someone who was duped by WikiLeaks.
Tom, Edward Snowden has recently been suggesting he is deserving of a presidential pardon before Barack Obama leaves office. It seems a long shot, but that aside, does he deserve one?
It's a long shot, and his best shot, even though it's a long shot, is probably toward the end of Obama's term, because if you're looking at Trump or you're looking at Clinton, you're looking at even stronger sentiments as far as trying to put Snowden in jail. So now is the time to take your shot. In fact, he was doing a news conference today, a video conference with New York, a gathering of Amnesty, the ACLU was there, et cetera, et cetera. His supporters trying to make the case now. He's got over 2 million, I think, people on Twitter as well. This is his shot. It may not be a good shot, but it's his only shot right now, so he's going to take it.
William, you were talking there about secrets and about how governments do need to keep them at some point. I don't think any serious person disputes that. The trouble is now, do you have to think a way of conducting, say, for example, looking at your former career in the diplomatic service, which is famously supposed to value discretion above almost all other virtues. Is it now the case, though, is the reality that other ways are going to have to be found of countries interacting with each other? Because you can no longer make the same assumptions that things will be kept secret, can you?
Yeah, well, you certainly have to assume that some things you thought were going to be secret are going to be public, but you just have to introduce more and more layers, because there are some things that need to be secret. Mm-hmm. I mean, the identity of your agents in other countries needs to remain secret, or those agents die. Your codes and who you're intercepting and what you can read needs to remain a secret, otherwise you won't be able to spy on anyone. Now, there's a perfectly legitimate argument that says nobody should spy on anyone. I frankly don't think you'll persuade the Russians and the Chinese that's a good place to be. So as democracies have to be able to do that. I do think there's a difference, though. You have to create a channel for people who think they're being asked to do things that are illegal, that think that the power of the state has got too big. And there needs to be ways for whistleblowers to say this is wrong and it needs to be looked at outside the confines of the organisation which is self-interested. So you can't expect the NSA or GCHQ to take a completely objective view. So you need to provide other ways for people to challenge the institutional view. And I think that's where I think, you know, Snowden has raised an issue that needs to be explored.
Just to follow that up, though, you talk about the need to add more layers to keep the things that need to be kept secret. But in the current climate, how difficult is to do that without inserting so many layers that no information can move at all?
Well, you have to fewer people. I mean, I think the Chelsea Manning case showed how the Americans have forgotten about keeping secrets. I mean, because there was absolutely no reason for Bradley Manning, as he was at the time, to have access to all that information. He didn't need it for his job. And so what happens is you get compartmentalized. I mean, ironically, the fact that he was able to do this seems to me the aftermath of 9/11, where the criticism of the intelligence agencies was they weren't sharing and they weren't telling each other what bits. So you had this greater sharing. So there's a to-ing and fro-ing here all the time.
It is a fine line. Tom, are you surprised? I was vaguely surprised myself, I think, that Edward Snowden's revelation about the extraordinary scope of government surveillance didn't actually appear to prompt widespread outrage. It prompted a measure of outrage among a very small and very angry group of people, and I think not without reason. But it did not appear to sort of completely scandalize the wider public. There were no streets choked with demonstrations.
I think a lot of the government spokespeople at that time were wrapping themselves in the flag and saying this is really, really bad. And, you know, I think others, over time, the polls will show that more people are swinging into his, if you will, side. It's probably about 50-50 today. And it really, really begs the question, why should a government have every phone record, every email record from me, from William, from you. I think that, you know, yes, secrets have to be secret, but they don't have to know that I went down and bought an ice cream down in the corner on my credit card today. It really, really begs the question. And I think this debate is out there now. People are ready for the debate now that they were not ready for 3 years ago.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we should move along to Switzerland, and it may strike anyone who has had the pleasure of travelling by rail in Switzerland that any efforts to render the network more efficient would be altogether redundant, on a par perhaps with attempting to make water wetter. But Swiss Federal Railways have thought of something. In order to ease the passage of passengers through Bern Station, it intends to install traffic lights for pedestrians. William, first of all, at the risk of stereotyping an entire people by their virtues, do you basically need to assume that you're dealing with Swiss people for something like this to work?
Yeah, I find it hard to think anywhere else in Europe where it could work, where you get the cooperation. You certainly need it for the, I mean, it's maybe a bit parochial for the listenership here, but it should be introduced in London Bridge. People may remember one of London's biggest stations, which had people rioting because they couldn't get access to platforms. You'd probably need it there, but I can't think of another country in Europe that would that anybody would obey a traffic light for pedestrians.
There are some. I mean, the other country where I think I could imagine this happening would be Taiwan. And I can remember walking through some of Taiwan metro or Taipei's metro stations. They had actual framed artworks hanging on the wall in the ticket concourse, you know, all of which would last about 10 minutes if you hung them up at Tottenham Court Road. But they were hanging there completely unguarded, unalarmed and unprotected. It does seem to be the case that, yeah, the societies that are already sort of preternaturally orderly are the ones who are thinking about doing this. But there is a serious point here, Tom. There are places where there are huge numbers of pedestrians swarming through them. Is there anything wrong with trying to regulate them?
I think we should try this, William. We differ on this. We should try it at Victoria or Hammersmith. Find your station during morning drive, because we also live in a world now where everybody and their mother is looking at their cell phone, their mobile phone, and I love it. You get off the train and it's crowded and people are trying to get on before you get off, and then people stop right by the stairs, and it's like you know, a scene from the Three Stooges.
Well, Sydney, more or less my hometown, is actually going to start installing traffic lights in the footpath in the central business district to stop people who are staring at their phones from walking into oncoming traffic.
It's sort of like a pedestrian mindset of driving. Keep it going, keep it flowing. But a lot of people don't want to play ball.
To some extent, it does happen in London, because you see, I mean, the London Bridge, a station I use frequently, at the peak times, they just shut half the barriers. So and that regulates the traffic onto the platform, because there's a safety issue. Too many people on the underground platforms can lead to jostling of people falling in. So there is a real need to control it at certain stations. Although the last time I was in Bern Station, that didn't strike me as they've got a problem on the scale that we have in London.
Again, this is what I was thinking. I've never used Bern Station, but I have used Zurich several times. I never once found something going, oh my God, this is pandemonium. Will somebody please take charge of this? There's so many interesting questions raised by this. I mean, I for one would certainly favour aggressively fining and possibly thrashing with a knotted rope people use who use umbrellas on crowded footpaths in London.
Yes, there you go. That's another one, yeah.
I think somebody needs to look into that. But
when it's not raining, you mean?
Well, even when it is raining. Yeah. Especially when it's raining, in fact. Wear a raincoat. I mean, it's not complicated. Are we going to see more of this, do we think, William?
Well, as cities get busier and busier, it's interesting that this is Swiss should introduce it, whether you're probably the calmest place in Europe. But as cities get busier and busier, we're going to have to introduce measures to control crowds, for sure.
Tom?
Yeah, why not? Give it a test run. See what happens.
On that ringing endorsement, Tom Rivers and Sir William Patey, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Rhys James, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Beatrice Carmi. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. Music next at 1900. Danny Giacopelli is in with the entrepreneurs, and I'll be back with more on today's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at 1800 London time tomorrow. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.